Prodigy, music for the jilted generation.
Magic people, voodoo people.
Although to many the indestructible Keith Flint is the face of the Prodigy, it's Liam Howlett, the non-stop inventive dynamo of the band, who's the man behind the music. Over the next 30 minutes, we talk to him extensively about Jilted Generation.
I'm not a mad sort of programmer. I'm pretty sort of box standard when it comes to that stuff, really.
And to his part-time co-producer, Neil McLennan and Pete Tong.
Music for the Jilted Generation was the sort of closing of the first chapter of the Prodigy's life.
The Essex stretch of the M25 might not have been the most fashionable amongst rave-goers at the end of the 80s, but take one of the slip roads leading north and you might just find yourself winding up in a small town called Braintree. It was here that the influence of rave and acid house, mixed with late 80s hip-hop and sampling culture, gave birth to the Prodigy. They made their chart debut with the now infamous single Charlie and went on to score four more top 20 hits and a top 20 album, Experience, all by the end of 1993. Charlie, however, had left a sour taste in some critics' mouths. Mixmag even launched a vicious front cover attack on the band in August 92, picturing Howlett with a gun to his head alongside the headline, "Did Charlie Kill Rave?" A bit harsh, but despite their early success, Howlett, never a man to stand still musically, knew things had to change.
I'd really had enough of, like, the so-called rave scene, as it were. You know, I think that it was so far removed from what we first got into it for. You know, at that point, it become really cheesy, definitely cheesy. And I kind of got into writing music by numbers in a way. You know, it was simple to choose samples and put beats over the top, and it became really boring. And I just hit a brick wall with that, and I just couldn't go any further with that. The definite point was when we played a gig called Resurrection in Scotland. You know, I remember looking out to the crowd. There was loads of young kids with glow sticks, and I was just thinking, this just isn't me anymore, you know, I just can't do this anymore, you know. And I thought at that particular point the band was going to finish. You know, this was before I started to record Jilted. This was like probably just before One Love, and I thought, no, this is it, this isn't me anymore. I was really wanting to get back to sort of beats and sort of more of a hip-hop darker feel, you know, and I didn't know whether the Prodigy could actually come round to that, you know. And luckily enough, you know, sort of managed to write tracks that we could perform live better than we'd done the other stuff before.
This was a strange time for the Prodigy. The more chart success they had, the more they were criticised, particularly by the underground scene that they'd left behind. Liam, for one, wasn't happy, and he knew that the record that became Music for the Jilted Generation needed to set a new agenda rather than follow a now outdated one.
I think the point that actually changed musically for me was when I did a remix for Front 242. That was the point that really changed in my head where I wanted to go with the music, you know, and basically from that point onwards, everything followed. We had been sort of more or less mainstreaming for the last couple of years anyway, because every record we sort of released was hitting the charts at quite hard positions. That in itself annoyed me, you know, really. I know it sounds strange, but it did, because it was like not what we set out to do, and we're almost becoming too popular out of something I wasn't really totally enjoying. And so I had to sort of strip it back down and kind of more or less start again, really. And it definitely felt like recording the album was like a new start without a doubt. It definitely wasn't a continuation from the first album, whereas Fat of the Land was kind of an extension of Jilted.
In the summer of 1993, a white label was doing the rounds in the underground dance scene under the name of Earthbound. The tracks were picking up excellent reviews in the music press and going down a storm with DJs and punters alike. Earthbound were being hailed as a great new dance act, but the identity of the band was a mystery. Then it was revealed. Earthbound was the name of Liam Howlett's studio. The record was One Love. One Love was eventually released as a single in October 93 and became the band's fourth top 10 hit in the UK, and at the record company's insistence was included on Jilted Generation. Meanwhile, the rest of the album was taking shape in Liam's head. And not for the first time, Howlett was taking stock of where dance music was going and working out a way to stay ahead of the game.
A lot of my inspiration comes from kind of what was going on in the 70s with funk and like rare groove and stuff like that. And we hung out in America for quite a while, and kind of what was going on there, I was really influenced by that. The sort of street vibe that Nirvana had, and kind of wanted to just experiment, but always was with the beats, with the hip-hop beats, you know, all the time, you know, and just put the whole lot together and spat it out as the album.
1993 was the year the controversial Criminal Justice Bill was introduced into the UK, affecting the dance scene in a major way. It didn't help that at the time the UK's rock promoters were slow to embrace club culture at the big summer festivals. To play live, the Prodigy turned to Europe, where a more open booking policy saw them share the stage with countless guitar groups. Liam in particular benefited from the many different styles of music the band were exposed to during the Prodigy's extensive touring experiences. He began recording The Jilted Generation during the summer of 93.
I recorded the record in Braintree, in my house. Half of it there, half of it in Strong Room in London. Always record at night, never in the daytime, you know, and basically work through to sort of 3 or 4 in the morning, and then go to bed and basically get up, have a listen to it, tweak it, and then do whatever for the rest of the day, and then work on it at night again, you know, like that. And it was much better to record at home, even though the production wasn't perfect. It had a raw sort of quality about it, I think. You know, it wasn't a bedroom, it was a studio, but it was a low tech on the lo-fi side. I mean, I didn't have a lot of equipment, but just love working with the sampler, and that was my instrument and still is, you know, just love getting inside the sampler and really messing with sounds, twisting sounds up until you can't sort of recognise them and stuff, you know. I'm not one of these people that goes sort of like the Aphex Twin that goes really mad inside equipment. I kind of, once I get a sound, I mean, the sampler is my machine I'm really familiar with, you know. I'm not a mad sort of programmer. I'm pretty sort of box standard when it comes to that stuff, really.
Although musically Liam is the Prodigy, during the course of the album he collaborated on several tracks with producer Neil McLennan.
He's great to work with, you know. He's really, really good on the desk, and he does like to get inside equipment and get really deep inside it and pull out some mad stuff.
Neil McLennan.
We did really mad things, you know. We got a huge speaker and we put it underneath the grand piano, right? We put a brick on the sustain pedal, so his bass resonates across all the strings. If you listen to the track, one of the Breaking Glass on it, ching, and there's this... It's all sustain, natural acoustic sustain from a piano with a sub-bass going through it, man. Mic'd up the piano. And wicked things like that we did. With Liam, he might not know sometimes how to get what he wants, but he knows what he wants, which is, for my money, the sign of someone who's going to always be in control. A lot of the time, you work with people and they don't know what they want. But with Liam, bam, and it's straightforward. Because I think, personally speaking, he's a genius.
The more you talk to Howlett and revisit the Prodigy's back catalogue, the more I keep coming up with words like vision and intuition and, to be honest, phrases like, that clever bloke from the Prodge. But even your most far-sighted songwriter has to have a starting point, especially when it comes to that difficult second album.
It's like any album, when you kind of you set your mind on starting an album, you need kind of like a springboard track that sort of gives you a lift and a good vibe to sort of start recording. And I guess the first track was, it was Voodoo People for me. And so that was kind of like Firestarter was the springboard for Fat the Land. That was the springboard for that album. I purposely set out to do something totally different with that track. I wanted to use all live instruments, you know, bring instruments into the studio and record them and then put them back into the track, rather than sort of like picking up old samples from old records and trying to write a record that way.
The voodoo, hoodoo, what you don't dare do, people.
I had such a good buzz on for kind of really attempting something totally different. You know, sometimes things do come together really quickly. Firestarter came together in like 2 days, you know, and basically with that track it was the same type of thing. I got the loop, I had a guy come in and play some flute over the top, and various people come in to do sessions and stuff, and I just put the whole thing together, and it came together really quick, and it was finished in like about 4 days.
With Voodoo People pretty much in shape, he had to play the track to the rest of the band for their reactions.
It was a popular track. I mean, thinking back, I think Leroy probably was into it the most out of anyone. It's hard to tell until he put it on stage. I mean, the track went straight out on stage like the rest of the stuff. You know, we don't operate like a normal band where they record. You know, you spend sort of 3 or 4 months recording and then taking the stuff out. It's much more of an experimental process with what we do. We kind of record in the studio, take it out 1 week. I think the track went through a couple of minor changes and then it was ready, but it went down well straight away.
Liam has already told us he was influenced by Nirvana, as you can hear on Voodoo People, with the riff lifted from their track Very Ape. In recent years, with the Prodigy crossing paths with the Foo Fighters on the festival circuit, Liam couldn't avoid the inevitable confrontation with Dave Grohl.
I was in somewhere in Scandinavia. Foo Fighters were on stage. It was the first time I met Dave. And comes into the change room, starts speaking to Leroy. I was in the toilet or something. And he's like, "Hey, what's up, I'm Dave, you know? How's it going? Really into the band, think it's really cool. Had the album on when we were on tour, and basically you sampled Nirvana."
People, voodoo people.
And Leroy was like, "Do you know what I mean?" And he goes, "You better speak to him." Points to me. And so I sort of come over and I'm like, "How's it going?" You know, I knew it was going to happen one day, you know, it's bound to bump into him sooner or later. But basically, like, what I actually did was I got a guitarist to come in and replay that sample. And just kind of, it still kind of sounded like your track. And kind of tried to disguise it, but he's caught me, what can I say, you know? And he's like, luckily enough, he was into the record and he's into the band, and yeah, we love Dave, he's a cool guy.
Thanks to the actual recording of Jilted Generation, and Liam hit a serious writer's block.
I mean, it always happens, doesn't it? I mean, basically, it happened in the first album, the second album, and the third. I think it's me, really. It's like kind of trying to write an album in my own head that I'm totally happy with, and I've never done it. I've never written the perfect album in my own head. You know, there's always a couple of tracks. I mean, on Jilted, it was like half the album was definitely something that was kind of original and hadn't been done before, and the other half was like a final say goodbye to the past type of thing. But even the new stuff, I didn't feel it was so far removed from what we were doing before. It was definitely darker and a bit more mature, but it wasn't as if we'd done what Moby did and kind of forget about the dance scene and kind of go rock or try to go rock. It was like introducing guitars through samplers, twisting the guitars up and changing the sound of the guitars to kind of suit what we were doing in a more of a DJ way, rather than sort of like think we're a rock band and kind of add beats with guitars. Sometimes, you know, I'll be working late and then come in the next morning and it really sounds shit, you know. You kind of think, what was I doing the night before, you know, I wasn't on it. And then it doesn't take long to sort of kick it into some kind of shape. But I remember finishing Their Law, which was a kind of collaboration with Pop Will Eat Itself. We did a gig with them and I liked what they were doing on stage. I think they had a good sort of energy about them, and spoke to Clint and he sent me some guitars, you know, on tape, and I just sampled them off. And even people in the rock scene were trying to ask me how I recorded the guitars, because they didn't, you know, they were like, they sound really strange the way you've done them, but I put them on the sampler and time stretched them and come out with that sound, you know.
Their Law, with guitars courtesy of Pot Will Eat Itself. Just ahead of the album, the Prodigy released another single, No Good, Start the Dance.
That was probably one of the most commercial sounding records that we'd released, I think, you know, with a female vocal in that. It kind of almost went against everything we were about. It went through like three sort of different stages before it got to that finished stage. And it, first of all, it was kind of like had much more of an acid bass line in it. And without the vocal in it, it kind of was a really, really good instrumental. And I knew it needed something else, and I tried the vocal. You know, what can I say? It was one of those things that I'll never write anything like that again. It was just a one-off thing, but looking back on it now, I don't particularly like that track, to be honest, you know. I really don't. We stopped playing it live, but it became so formula. Probably like a year after the album came out, the Prodigy finished with Start the Dance. You know, that was the last track.
Liam may not favour the track anymore, but when the single was reviewed in the New Musical Express, journalist Tommy Udu wrote, "The Prodigy are almost beyond criticism. This is 90s bubblegum pop that will be remembered fondly for decades to come." Although as a band they'd already played some of the new songs live, with the album all but complete, it was time for Liam to unveil the remaining tracks to Keith, Leroy and Maxim.
I think they knew it was something different, and none of us really cared whether it was going to do well or not, because it was kind of an achievement. And maybe a lot of tracks on the album the guys were kind of shocked with. I think Poison, because it was such a down-tempo track to what we'd been doing before, a lot of people that I played it to, sort of some of the press, were like, this is really different, you know, this is like a new direction. I think people expected me to go back to doing hip-hop or something.
As it sunk in that the record was finished and that the band were ready to push forward, Liam hit another problem. He went to cut the record and it was too long. So a track called We Eat Rhythm was dropped, One Love was edited, and so was The Heat, The Energy. Having finished the record, the next task was to agree on a name for it. Since its release, the title has been widely associated with the criminal justice bill. But to Howlett, music for the jilted generation has a much broader meaning.
It was an idea in my head, but I couldn't find the right words to describe what I wanted to say, you know, and kind of, I said, I described it to the other guys, and I was like, this is what I want to do, you know, what do you think? And we kind of threw loads of stupid things around, you know, and kind of came out of that in the end. It was still pretty stupid, but it sounded good, you know. And it kind of fitted the vibe of the whole discontent with the dance scene at the time, you know. It was a weird time for the sort of, with the criminal justice bill and all that type of thing. And I think the album had a definite vein of anger running through it, which was really sort of important for us, even though we didn't want to write a criminal justice bill album. I mean, one thing I will say is that the picture in the middle was a reflection on what we'd been feeling in the dancing for the last 3 years. It definitely wasn't a kind of, the criminal justice bill's coming up, so we'll do that. I had to sort of explain to a lot of people that that really wasn't the case when it came to the title and their law and the picture in the album.
Now, we all remember the feverish anticipation surrounding the release of the Prodigy's third album, The Fat of the Land, but Jilted Generation was a different story.
We just didn't have anything to prove, and it was just me going out and kind of going back to what I was doing before, in a way. I mean, like, Poison was, like, a total hip-hop track, and it was really cool to kind of forget about the rave scene and just go back to what I was doing, like, 5 years before. We were just on our own tip, we really were. We weren't on this kind of, like, yeah, we've got to kind of lead the way for something new. I mean, I think people who think that, it never happens anyway. It was an important record when you look back, but at the time it wasn't like in my head, oh, this record's got to be so important, because at that time we still weren't particularly big, you know. It was only after Jilted came out that the band became much bigger. So it was definitely the end of a confusing time for me. I mean, at that particular point, I remember a lot of the dance scene was going more progressive, into sort of a progressive sort of house sort of sound, and I wasn't with that at all. I was never really into that kind of smoother sound. I was more into the rougher sort of hip-hop style production and beats, so I kind of stayed with that, but tried to sort of mould that into something that hadn't been done particularly well before.
But what did Liam think of his finished album?
But I'd definitely done something that was different to what I'd done before. I didn't even think about it on any sort of commercial level, you know. I just kind of thought, yeah, this record's, it's good, I'm happy with it. Even though some of the tracks I thought we could have done away with, I think that we could have done without Full Throttle, One Love and one other I can't think of. I think the album was strong enough without them tracks, you know. I knew the album was good, you know. I knew in my mind, I thought the tracks were killer live tunes, and that's what they were designed for. They were designed to go on the road and be maximum impact tracks for the live. And the thing with that album is we played, I mean, The Fat of the Land, 100%, every track we can play live. With that album, I'd say it was about 70% of it we played, and the rest we never bothered, you know, because they weren't really, they were more album tracks.
Although not all the reviews were, excuse the pun, raves, hardcore Prodigy fans welcomed the record with open arms. Select magazine gave it 5 out of 5, with then-editor Andrew Harrison claiming, "Music for the Jilted Generation is the best electronic pop record you'll hear all year. The instant head rush of techno, studded over with irresistible hooks and a series of merciless grooves." Liam, meanwhile, looked on as the press bandwagon really began to roll.
It wasn't one of these albums that came out and was like, everyone got on it and said, yeah, this is a cool album. I think that maybe The Enemy and Melody Maker gave good reviews, but I think it took a lot more time for people to kind of pick up on it and kind of say, and give it the respect it deserved, I think, you know. And now people can look back and some people like it more than Fat of the Land, which is fair enough, you know. It was the foundation for Fat of the Land, though, to be honest, in what we're doing now.
Of all the acres of print that would follow Jilted Generation's release, there were some real gems. The NME even described Howlett as RoboCop and modern-day Beethoven rolled into one. Dom Phillips of Mixmag.
When I first heard Jilted Generation, I think I was quite shocked because I'd been the person at Mixmag involved in quite a vicious attack on the Prodigy around the time of the Charlie Rave hit, where we had Liam Howlett with a gun to his head and the headline, Did Charlie Kill Rave? I was listening to it on a Walkman going to somebody's dinner in Pimlico in London. The album starts with the sound of a typewriter and a voice going,
I've decided to take my work back underground.
As they'd been burning copies of Mixmag in their videos and stuff, it was fairly clear what that was aimed at. And I just listened to it and I was totally, totally blown away. I was in a state of shock. It didn't sound like anything I'd ever heard before. I didn't know if I liked it or not, or if it was good or not. It was certainly really powerful. And I kind of walked into this meal and sat down and I didn't really say anything to anyone for ages because I was like, my God, what was that? It was amazing. And it was a big shock and it didn't take long to, you know, totally fall in love with the record.
Liam Howlett.
A lot of people in the dancing were totally confused because I think at the time we wanted to always stay with the beats and everyone was sort of going back to 4/4 progressive house and all these stupid little kind of categories people come out with and stuff. And I think the initial reaction to the album was a lot of people were confused with the more experimental tracks like kind of Voodoo, Breaking Into, Their Law, Poison, tracks like that, you know.
Jilted Generation was released in July 1994. Within 1 week it had gone silver, selling in excess of 60,000 copies. It went straight into the UK album chart at number one, outselling its nearest competitor 3-1.
To have a number one album is like a, you know, that's a statement, you know, and that was a good thing for the whole of the dance scene. It was like, I was proud that we'd written an album that hadn't compromised on any level, but had pushed forward quite a bit. I knew when I finished the album that certain tracks were kind of breaking new ground. I didn't know whether, at that particular time, whether we were going to lose fans, gain new fans, whatever. It didn't matter. It could have been the death of the band, to be honest. You know, it was like I was just happy that I'd recorded an album I liked, you know. Like any album, there's tracks in there people really hate, and, you know, I don't think people really got on the thing of 3 Kilos, that track, you know, and that kind of narcotic sweet thing. But I enjoyed writing it, and it had its place on the album.
Jilted Generation received a further accolade when it was nominated for the 1994 Mercury Music Prize for Album of the Year. The band found themselves up against the likes of Blur's Parklife, Oasis's Definitely Maybe, and Paul Weller's Wildwood. M People's Elegant Slumming walked off with the prize, but the fact that they were shortlisted indicated a wider acceptance and respect for the Prodigy. The album did, however, go on to win the Independent Dance Awards Best Dance Album Gong, and the band scooped Best Dance Act at the MTV Awards. 6 months after the album's release, Liam Howlett must have been pretty happy with Jilted Generation.
It's easy to sort of look back and say that track could have been mixed better, that track could have done with little things, you know, like sort of like production things and kind of the fact that I could have lost 3 tracks off the album and it would have probably been seen slightly different if certain tracks weren't on there. I mean, it's easy. I mean, no album, I've never written a perfect album and never will, you know. I think at that time I was happy, yeah.
As a landmark record, it would still take a while for the Prodigy's influence to sink into the mainstream and for Howlett to appreciate the knock-on effects that the record would eventually create.
At the time, I don't particularly remember many sort of songs that from the dance scene that sounded like what I was doing, but I remember an awful lot of rock records that got inspired by using beats rather than coming from that side, rather than people from this side. To be honest, I don't remember listening to any dance music that year. Yeah, I really don't.
But if Liam wasn't listening to dance music, the dance music scene was certainly listening to him. Pete Tong.
I think they really did set the example, the first example of how it should be done, and many bands have since followed in their wake. Not to say that they were the first act to make a whole album of dance, but they were real sort of band albums, and obviously Orbital, Left Field, Underworld, people like Goldie have followed in their footsteps since. So that was the major impact. I think they just set the example of how it should be done.
So they were setting a new agenda for the dance scene, but what did Jilted Generation do for the Prodigy themselves, once the outcasts of the rave scene? Dom Phillips of Mixmag.
It reinvented the Prodigy. That when the album came out, the dance scene was at first shocked, And I think it went for it really, really well, because it also tied in with the whole breaks thing and the trip-hop thing that was going on at the time. It was 1994, so there was a lot of that going on. In terms of a wider audience, it convinced a lot of people outside the dance scene, because it was quite angry and there was a sort of vague veneer of politics about it. A lot of the indie press and the indie people suddenly embraced it as well. Suddenly they'd found a dance record that they felt had something more to it, stood for something more, so they could embrace it, because they have, you know, those agendas are often required. So it had a huge effect there, and it totally reinvented the Prodigy as a serious creative force.
This new widespread appeal was not accidental. Here's Liam Howlett again.
We were totally set on the fact that, from more of a live side, that there could be something that could come together on sort of more of a festival level, that was like almost like a start of a new scene, which was like a kind of new alternative scene for England, I think. You know, it wasn't just rock, or it wasn't just dance, it was something in between that kind of we thought we'd start, you know, sort of had something to do with sort of starting the ball rolling. And kind of, you know, from America, I guess Beck was kind of doing, I wouldn't say similar, but you know, do you know what I mean? A comparison to what we were trying to do. We sort of saw like a new sort of cool scene develop, you know, from playing festivals. And nowadays, you go to a festival and you're like, if a dance stage wasn't there, you'd be like, well, where's the dance stage? You know, you'd be shocked if there wasn't one. So, I mean, that's cool.
Looking back on Jilted Generation, it was the album that pretty much proved that you didn't have to compromise to be successful. It was an inspiring record, and not just within the clubs. It would pave the way for all manner of future scenes and spin-offs, good and bad. Mixmag's Dom Phillips.
I mean, the whole Big Beat thing, you know, it definitely owes a lot to Jilted Generation. The energy and the kind of rock dynamics that they use. They use hip-hop rhythms and they use funk rhythms really cleverly, and they use a lot of rock dynamics, and that was where they really got it right on that record. And I think everything from Norman Cook to Bentley River Maze to even possibly bands like Audio Web, you know, I think a lot of people have taken note of that album and then that collection of stars, because they were beyond the dance act and beyond the rock act. They had a bit of everything, and they were no longer in any one school. And that's when the Prodigy really went, because anyone could like them. You weren't buying into an agenda that belonged to anyone else apart from the Prodigy. You know, it wasn't like I'm a dance fan or I'm a raver or I'm an indie kid. I'm just like, I like the Prodigy.
Despite being released nearly 5 years ago, and given the pace that dance culture moves at, just try going back to Jilted Generation and having listened to it. Still sounds pretty knee trembling, doesn't it? Dom Phillips again.
I think it sounds as good now as it did then. It really is a great album. I think it's better than Fat of the Land, which is still a good album, but this is the Prodigy at their peak.
Pete Tong.
I think it still stands the test of time. Tracks like Voodoo People and Poison, obviously, and No Good Start the Dance. They sort of ended an era for the Prodigy with this album. And I think 1994, and Music for the Jilted Generation was the sort of closing of the first chapter of the Prodigy's life before tracks like Firestarter, of course.
You can define Jilted Generation's success in pretty much any way you want. Commercially, it's gone on to sell in excess of 700,000 copies in the UK and over 2 million worldwide. As an influence on the music scene, it's had arguably just as big an effect. Imagine a world without the Prodigy, without their colour and charisma, not to mention Howlett's conviction to drag dance music kicking and screaming into the next century. In the clubs, at the festivals, live and on record, in 1994, the Prodigy gave voice to a generation of misfits, partygoers, clubbers, workers, DJs and producers. If ever there's a band who can claim to have captured the mood of the country's youth, then knowingly or unwittingly, it's the Prodigy. And if you had to describe the album in 15 words to an alien, you'd hardly know where to start.
See, at the time it came out, I couldn't even answer that question then. You know, it was like, I still can't. We did almost set out to do something that couldn't be categorised. That was one of the things that kind of, and still does, really piss me off with, like, critics. They kind of love to create these stupid things, and we created one ourselves, you know, and we said, yeah, this is electronic punk, which, you know, looking back on it, wasn't really, you know, but, like, it was just one of those stupid things we were throwing around at the time, you know, and I think that was kind of also the birth of Keith Flint, that sort of album, and it kind of led on to what was to become. But I really can't describe what that album is. It's just, all I see that I do is I pick up on the various street scenes I'm into and just spit it out as an album, you know, and that's what I did with that album.
Ultimate Street Scenes, Volume 1.
Sounds like one of those old electro albums.
Prodigy and music for the Jilted Generation. Thank you very much to Liam Howlett in the making of that programme.